Welcome to a new episode of the China Flexpat podcast. And this is a great episode today because we're talking about resilience, staying here for nearly 20 years in China with a family. And this is not so easy. And the question is it luck or are skills involved? And what should we really focus on, what we can learn today? With this, welcome, Martin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. My name is Dr. Martin Lockström, originally from Sweden. Been now in China for almost 18 years. I arrived in China back in 2006. I have to finish my PhD at European Business School in Germany. And after I graduated from European Business School, so I got a job offer to come over to China and start doing some research and teaching activities there. After spending 3.5 years at Tongji University, I moved on to a new position, similar position at China Europe International Business School, where I helped building up a research institute in the areas of purchasing and supply management. There is this, unwritten law of nature that, you know, if you spend more than 4 to 5 years in China, you know, you're never going to leave. After having worked a couple of months for Infosys, it turned out that my job location would actually be Frankfurt. Worked as IT consultant for Infosys there for roughly 2 years. And toward the end of 2013, I have to admit, I started to get a little bit bored. After you have grown accustomed to living in China, you know, with the dynamism here and, you know, the fast pace and so on and so forth, it's a little bit of a, you know, reverse culture shock, you know, moving back to Europe. And even though Frankfurt is, you know, one of the larger, you know, metropolitan areas in Europe, comfortable lifestyle, you know, you live in a house, you know, in a suburb, you know, you're having your own car and so on. But I was kind of still missing, you know, the life back here in China. And when I got a job offer at a boutique consultancy here in Shanghai, in the end of 2013, it didn't take long before I made up my decision to quit my position in Germany and assume this new position at this consulting company here in Shanghai. So subsequently, you know, I moved my family, two kids, two cats, sold my house, sold my car, and moved back to Shanghai, where I've now been ever since. So now we're basically in early 2014. Spent a couple of years working at that consulting company, moved on to various industry positions. Worked at a Dutch chemical company for a couple of years. And then in 2016, I decided to found my own consulting firm, basically, which has been operating since. And as of 2020, my main job has been at Xi'an Jiao Tong Liverpool University, where I'm a senior associate professor of operations management.
You're going to stay forever now?
Never say never. You know, the thing with me is like the only like kind of fixed term I had was with my first contract here in China, which spanned roughly 5 years, was subsequently extended a little bit. But I never said, like, you know, this is a place I want to stay for the rest of my life. But on the other hand, I've also always held the view that, you know, there's no other place that I would like to live in. You know, there's no more exciting place to be at the moment, you know, despite the, you know, the hardships that we've gone through over the past few years.
So let's start with reasons to leave. So you have kids. So how do you reduce the cost of living for your family?
I never had lofty, you know, housing allowances or, you know, schooling allowance, car allowance, something like that. I never had that. I only depended, you know, on my own salary, basically. So that means I never lived in a quote-unquote traditional expat compound. I always lived, you know, in a local community. So, I mean, everyone who lives in Shanghai basically knows it's a two-tiered market. You have the local real estate market and you have the expat real estate market, where the latter is typically 2 to 3 times more expensive than the local market, for the simple reason that the expat real estate market is financed not by the person who lives in the apartment, but the company at which this person is employed. So it's totally different dynamics in those two markets, which explains the price difference. As I never had a housing allowance, you know, I always lived in a local community and paid, you know, local rent. I never had schooling allowance. You know, after my kids were born, we didn't, you know, going to international kindergarten, not an option. We had to put them in a local kindergarten, local private kindergarten, though. So from the very beginning, they had been groomed into local Chinese society. My kids are Swedish, look totally foreign, you know, pretty much like me, you know, blonde hair and so on and so forth. They have always been in this kind of environment surrounded only by, you know, Chinese kids, Chinese people, so to say. And that has progressed, you know, when they started primary school, international school, no option, you know, assuming that we want to, you know, stay in the country. We subsequently decided to put them in a local public school. So I thought, you know, why would foreign kids be any more stupid than Chinese kids? It doesn't really make sense to me. I said to my wife back then, let's give it a try. If it works, it works. If it doesn't work, we have to come up with something else. What's the point of being in China in the first place, right? I'm not here to hang out with people that only look like me. I'm here to experience new things, meet new people, experience new culture, eating new types of food, right?
So do you have, apart from housing and school, do you have any other advice to reduce cost of living?
I think otherwise, you know, when it comes to reducing cost, so, you know, back in the days, you know, when we didn't have supermarkets like Hema, and if you wanted to have any, you know, imported food, you had to go to like City Super or things called City Shop, where you buy imported goods, basically. So this, and if you compare to, you know, the two same products, imported products in, let's say, City Super versus Hema, it's probably, you know, factor five. So I think first thing any foreigner, well, anyone in this country should do is, you know, check out Hema and, you know, install the APP and, you know, start shopping at Hema. I mean, they have fantastic assortment, low price and amazing customer service, you know, amazing, you know, delivery, all these kind of things as well. So I think food in general, let's say, like if you dine out, it's probably double, you know, over my time here. But if you look at, let's say, imported goods have, you know, definitely come down, you know, things like, you know, cheese, you know, wine, these kind of things, because competition has increased so much. So you don't have this kind of skimming prices anymore for most imported products. I think, you know, definitely helped reducing at least some expenses for, you know, food and drinks at least. So yeah, education, accommodation, and then food. I think that's three, you know, pretty big buckets of spend, basically.
And if you would ask them to relocate to Sweden when they're 16, maybe, would that be possible to just switch schools to Sweden?
Yeah, so now they're 11 and 13. You know, they love going to Sweden, you know, in summer, during winter, you know, all the, you know, fun activities that we do there. You know, they like, the country per se, and, you know, like seeing, you know, grandma, grandpa, and so on, so all these kind of things. But when I ask them, I ask this question, you know, do you want to move to Sweden? And say, like, no. You know, it's like, you know, despite, you know, the hardship they are going through here, it's like still, you know, China is their home. You know, they might look like two blonde little foreign girls, but I think they're only aware of this when they're brushing their teeth and looking at themselves in the bathroom mirror in the morning. So the rest of the time, they behave like any other Chinese kids. They're not even reflecting on that they're foreigners, actually. They actually speak Chinese to themselves, even though they're fluent in both Swedish and English. They very often speak Chinese to themselves. They even talk in their sleep in Chinese, you know. So it's so China is their home. Whether they want to relocate, you know, at a later stage, maybe. I think everyone wants, you know, go out and see the world, right? But we actually even have the option that they pursue higher studies here in China, so they can actually do Gaokao.
What made you happy, even in difficult times, to say this is the road that we're taking?
My kids very often, you know, they're very tired. You know, a couple of months ago, you know, they had the midterm exam, you know, studying like crazy, you know, day and night, 7 days per week. Now we're approaching, you know, the end term exams. So now they're studying day and night, 7 days a week. They're often, you know, they're tired and sometimes they're frustrated. They just keep pushing. They just keep grinding. And I don't know if my kids are unique, if I'm blessed or whatever, but we never have any challenge like we have to trying to convince them or, you know, yell at them or, you know, in any way, like, you know, punish them into submission. It's rather the opposite. It's usually me who tell my kids, like, you know, let's go and do this and that. And, you know, my kids would say, no, we cannot. You know, we have homework, or we have to study, blah, blah, blah. And I'm saying, like, yeah, come on, drop your books. Come on, stop. Let's go out. And it's like, no, I cannot. They just never complain. The key thing here is kind of tease out this kind of intrinsic, you know, motivation. Not pressure them too hard. I mean, I think a Chinese school is very challenging. I think where it goes too far is, you know, I hear a lot of stories about other Chinese parents. You know, they put their kids in a lot of, you know, extra classes, like extra English classes and math class and blah, 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 in addition to the workload they already have. And I think the marginal benefit of that is very, very limited. And I think that tend towards zero, actually. I mean, when you've been studying, you know, 12 hours per day, 5 days per week, you know, you need 1 or 2 days of rest. And if you don't have that, I think eventually, you know, your energy will run out.
Do you think your kids get this rest? They get 2 days of rest?
2 or 3 weeks before midterm and end term exam, not enough. But apart from that, we always try to keep the weekends free. And then they can decide completely.
Okay.
You know, whatever they want to do, kind of, you know, pastime activities. So then we let them totally loose, so to say, to decide if they want to do some sports or go to a park or go out, you know, riding bikes or going shop, going to restaurants, something like that. But we've never put them in, you know, extra class. We might have had like a tutor coming over and help them, you know, preparation, you know, before exam week. Yes, but never, they have never attended a single class. And both of them are actually in the top decentile. You should be rewarded with spare time and fun activities if you have done some really hard work. I think that's the best reward you can give them, actually.
Based on your story of high performance in all of these different cultures, Sweden, Germany, China, do you think that your kids profit from this, from your drive that they see this and that they want to be top performers as well?
I definitely believe they do. I mean, as I said, the hardship that they are getting through, I'm totally convinced that that will make them very, very strong. Everything they learn in school, they learn tremendous amounts. That will also, you know, make them very, very, you know, competitive in the labor market. Their understanding of, you know, Chinese culture, the language, I mean, they're fluent, you know, 100% fluent in Mandarin Chinese, both, you know, oral and in writing. They also, you know, conversational, even in Shanghaihua, in Shanghainese, you know. Meanwhile, you know, they also understand, you know, Western culture, you know, they have traveled, you know, different places and so on and so forth. Very often I have to take help from my kids.
So they're high performers already.
Yeah, I tell my older daughter that you would definitely be able to be CEO of a Chinese company right now, because it's like you have this, you know, people orientation. It's like you're determined, you can communicate, you're not afraid at all. You can communicate with all these, you know, senior Chinese people. And the interesting thing I see, it's like when these people, like a policeman, you know, talking to my daughter, because they are so fluent in the language and all the idiosyncrasies of the language and the culture, that they forget that they're standing in front of a foreign child and having these conversations with them. They just like disappears, you know, because it's the communication is so fluent, and it's just mind-boggling to watch for me, you know. And I will never reach that stage. I'm no chance, you know. So I'll keep struggling, but I get a lot of joy, you know, seeing them performing so well in such situations.
So how do your kids react to your diverse jobs, and your entrepreneur and your professor? How do they describe you, and how do they react to this very international lifestyle?
Being a professor in China, it confers high status as well. It's more about, you know, I think how their friends and, you know, friends' parents perceive me as a...
So they call you Jiao Shou?
Normally they call me doctor, so like, you know, okay. Mating Borshu. So yeah, it confers pretty high status here in this country, which is fun.
Do you enjoy more being a professor or being a consultant entrepreneur?
I always, you know, try to have, you know, one foot in in each world, so to say, to, you know, always combine the both, because I think you can really, you know, get access to good empirical data, and you can apply academic rigor, you know, in consulting projects, so to say. So this is also very valuable results that, you know, we can bring back to corporate partners, as I said. So I think if you can combine that, you really get the best of both worlds, I would say.
And can the Chinese system, do they accept this? So do they let you do your own shop while you teach?
Some do, some don't. So I mean, it's totally up, you know, to the institution that you're working for. So it all depends, you know, on the policy. But most of the time, you know, if you disclose, you know, your external assignments, you know, if you don't engage in like any competing activities, then most of the cases it's usually no problem. But as I said, it varies from institution to institution, so there's no like all encompassing definitive statement I can say about that.
So we do this podcast because we believe that flexpats are the future. So we believe that there will always be a need for international professionals like you and me and your kids to be working and growing in this culture, but it should not be as expats. So what is your advice to be a good flexpat?
So in Western culture, we have this DEI concept, right? A lot of companies talking about. So diversity, equity, inclusivity, right? Having a diverse workplace. The funny thing is, though, that, you know, when I've been visiting companies, you know, over the years that I've been in China, every time I went to a foreign company, there was always, you know, a bunch of, let's say, expats or foreigners. But the share of foreigners have, you know, pretty much been in precipitous decline. So the purpose of an expat is to come here, train the locals, eliminate yourself, and then you go back to the headquarters, or you're being relocated to somewhere else, some other country. The locals here, they have also become more skilled, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
Students with overseas degrees, you know, coming back to China every year from top business schools from all around the world and so on and so forth. So China, in that sense, China has become more self-sufficient, even though there's a war for talent. So globally capable talent is still scarce. So that I understand, you know, from that point of view, it's understandable that the percentage of expat has been going down. And obviously, you know, a fellow off the cliff, you know, during the pandemic for obvious reasons. That's a no-brainer. So I think the 10-year leading up to the pandemic, probably 50% disappeared of the original number of expats residing in China, you know, back in, let's say, 2010. During the pandemic, 50% of the remaining 50% pretty much disappeared as well. But in this discussion, I think it's very interesting that among foreign companies, there doesn't seem to be a DEI discussion in China relating to diversity, equity, and inclusivity.
Do you think this will come back? So you will think one day they will realize that it's actually a value to have maybe a person from India, from Germany, from Sweden working in China?
Well, I think definitely they will, because I mean, if you want to upkeep, you know, a corporate culture, in many respects, that culture is also, you know, somehow tied to the national culture of the country in which that company is headquartered, right? So I mean, when we talk about culture, it's about, you know, basic values, beliefs, you know, what is right and wrong, you know, how you should do things and so on and so forth. So culture is basically, you know, like an onion, right? You're peeling an onion. So the outer layer is basically, you know, the country culture, right? So a company is influenced by the country culture of the country which is headquartered, right? So a German company, the corporate culture is of course influenced by German country culture, right? You know, worth ethics and all these kind of things, social security and so on and so forth. When you peel off that layer, you come into the corporate culture. When you peel off that layer, you come into like a department culture. I mean, every company, different departments even have different cultures. You peel off that layer, you come down to like a team culture. You peel off that layer, you come down to, you know, your own individual culture, your own values and beliefs, right? So if you want to ensure alignment, you know, from top to bottom, from the outermost shell into the core down to each individual, I think it's important, you know, to keep that linkage. And you might say, yeah, but, you know, people might say, yeah, we just send, you know, a bunch of Chinese, you know, to Germany. We train them there for a few weeks or a few months.
They play by the rules. They understand compliance and so on. Yeah, I know. They're good Chinese.
I don't think it is that easy, actually, because, like, the kind of, you know, country culture, it takes a very, very long time to change. I think it's a multi-year or decade-long endeavor. I mean, I myself, I've been in China now, you know, my 18th year. I usually say these days that, you know, I'm like mentally, I'm more than 50% Chinese in that sense, right? But that has been like, you know, a very, very long journey, right? So I think when you do this kind of like a quick fix, you know, you reduce the number of expats in order to reduce labor costs or, you know, total compensation costs, because traditional expats, they're very expensive, as we all know, then I think they lose out this cultural dimension, because culture and values and these kind of things, it's something that has be that it has to be, you know, continuously maintained. This is like process management as well, you know, all these kind of things, they don't happen and sustain themselves. They have to be, like, you know, nurtured and cultivated. So I think in that sense, at least theoretically, flexpats should have a big advantage, because from a total compensation point of view, they're probably just a fraction as expensive as a traditional expat. They have typically better knowledge and expertise, you know, by virtue, most of the time they have spent a sizable amount of time here, usually, you know, beyond the 4 or 5, you know, year traditional expat mark, so to say. So they typically already, you know, integrated here in society. And, you know, like yourself, you know, you have a Chinese wife, you understand the local culture. As far as I understand, you speak the local language as well. So people like you, well, I'm not fluent, so I more refer to you here. Good flexpat should have tremendous potential. But then there's also a flip side of the coin, in the sense that the more Chinese you become, the more you also start to compete with the locals, if you know what I mean. I fully agree with you there as well. So if you have started learning it, like at university level, it's a fact, you know, the day has only 24 hours, right? So the more time you devote to learning Chinese, the more you will sacrifice in terms of learning other things, in terms of pursuing a professional career, so to say. So there is, at least at adult age, there is a clear trade-off between the two. So you as a flexpat, you really have to determine, like, what is the sweet spot? What is the balance between the two?
And this is what I tell everybody who I'm talking to make sure that they find their sweet spot, why they work in China, what they can do better than anyone else.
I think there are two criteria in order to be able to get hired here. And one is, I mean, you need to have like an absolute advantage. You need to be able to bring something to the table, right? You need to be able to add value as an employee. I mean, that is a no-brainer. And that what you bring to the table, you know, has to exceed, you know, the cost you're incurring to the company in terms of compensation and so on and so forth. But if you do, you have a very good advantage, you know, to find a well-paid job here in China.
Yeah, that was always my target, to say I want to earn a German salary in China. And the thing is, it's worth looking for this kind of job. It's difficult, I agree, but it's worth it. And I think this is a good meeting today, because you're so inspiring, and I will really hope that everybody reach out to you like I did to learn from you. And we'll put all your stuff in the show notes with this. Thank you so much, Dr. Martin.
Thank you. 谢谢你。谢谢。再见。再联系吧。
谢谢。再见。